Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jamie. March is Women's History Month, and Jaws of Justice Radio wants to spend our airtime talking with local women who have been and still are creating the history of our community. These women are truly heroes and need to be recognized as such. On today's broadcast, host David Bell talks with Monique Willis of Mama on a Mission about their efforts to help family members of murder victims and their fundraising event, Walk a Mile in My Shoes 2017, coming up this Saturday. Then, in the second half of our show, Jeff Humfeld talks with Christy Childs about Veronica's Voice and their newest project, Magdalene KC, a residential facility for women trying to escape prostitution. There will be no calendar of events this week, but stay tuned for the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Up next is David Bell and Monique Willis.
Good morning, this is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice. On today's show, we have a special guest, Monique Willis from Mama on a Mission, Inc. You know, we a lot of times talk about the criminal justice system and the treatment of defendants, whether through the court, police, and then prison. But in this show, we're going to talk about the impact of crime on others, not to say that those same aspects of the criminal justice system don't also fall on victims and their families. But in this episode, we'll talk to a mother of a victim who has started a very special organization that is having a fundraiser that's coming up this week. I want to welcome Monique Willis to the show. Monique, thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
As I understand it, your son, Alonzo,
correct.
Thomas IV, was killed in April 2014.
That is correct.
And if it's okay, if you could just briefly describe that, what we know to this date and the kind of the status of the investigation.
It's unsolved. Alonzo Thomas IV is one of Kansas City unsolved homicides that occurred April 5th, 2014 in the 7100 block of Wayne. He was on the phone. He was in the area with some friends on a nice Saturday afternoon. Received a phone call to come outside. A shooting occurred, and I know nothing. That's pretty much all I know.
And since that time, you've gone on to start an organization called Mama on a Mission, Inc. Why did you start the organization, and what is it?
Because I know nothing, so therefore I know other families know nothing. I know people need help in the system with communication and information. So I'm out in the community letting families know that the killer's in the streets, advocating for those families of homicide victims, letting them know about the different unsolved homicides. I'm also helping families with funeral arrangements and services financially.
You know, I was thinking about our discussion that was going to happen today and thinking about the loss of a loved one, and particularly a child, it's almost too difficult in and of itself to imagine. And you've gone through it and living through it. And I was wondering what your goal is of this, in that, meaning, what are you trying to get to? I mean, part of me is just in awe that you're able to get up every morning and continue moving.
Mm-hmm.
But I tried to categorize it into different types of goals, like an emotional goal, spiritual goal, community, criminal justice side, other. Where is it you hope to get to, I guess, personally, yourself, and then on behalf of the community?
I want answers. I want answers for my son's homicide. I want answers for other families' homicides. I mean, because there's a lot of unanswered questions going on in the city, and people need to speak up and come forward with those information, because someone knows something.
A lot of our program deals with issues, we'll call them issues, problems with the criminal justice system, problems that occur between police and members of various communities, particularly African-American community.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hear with you wanting to have this person's killer come forward, or your son's killer, or someone who knows who did it. But we're also very much aware of this tension that occurs of people not wanting to trust the police,
mm-hmm.
for many times justifiable reasons. So how do you overcome that tension? And is that something you've experienced or come across? And how do you advise people to overcome it?
It's education and awareness. At my walk, that's going to occur April 1st, Saturday, 9 o'clock at Zodiac Motorcycle Club, I will have Kansas City Crime Stoppers there and available to speak to them how to report a tip anonymously, because some people associate Crime Stoppers with the police, mm-hmm. when that's two different separate entities.
But ultimately, it looks like it's an authority figure. I guess I'm more concerned just from a global standpoint. How do you get past the general distrust of the system? Meaning, it's going to go to the Crime Stopper. It's going to go to the police.
Mm-hmm.
In dealing with that, what do you tell people that come up to you and say, hey, there's no way I'm going to talk to the police or anybody even connected to the police? How do you overcome that distrust that's built up over decades?
Again, it's communication and resources and some education. Let them know they are here to help. I mean, true enough, the police can help you and they can also hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to overcome that, if you want answers, there are some things you have to take care of to get what you need to take care of.
You mentioned as part of your group, help with funeral expenses.
Correct.
And I know we're talking about a very personal subject, but it's one that's obviously really important to you, and you've made it known publicly, your experience. What happens, if you could walk our audience through the unbelievable situation, you get a call that, or you're at the hospital, your son has passed, how does a crime victim get money to, what happens then? How does a crime victim get money to help bury a child or a family member? And then who do you talk to? And I don't need specific names, but who mm-hmm. do you talk to about the status of the investigation? Do you call once a week? Does someone call you once a week? How does that all work?
Once you're notified, then there's different resources that could be provided to you.
Mm-hmm.
Communication with the police, it depends on who your detective is. Some people have rather, hands-on detectives that will communicate with them, and some, you have to keep pushing and forcing the issue with them and contacting them on a regular basis. Finances with funeral homes. Some funeral homes may take advantage of you or your situation and your struggles, knowing that you may not have the funds available. So that's when I come involved. I will write a check of a certain amount directly to the funeral home and work with you to know who you're working with and what services you may or may not need. You have crimes victims compensation. They will provide $5,000 to you, but that's after the fact, after the death has occurred with a death certificate and after certain paperwork has been accomplished. So it's a process, but it's just not knowing the process and having someone by your side like myself and some other organizations that will help you walk you through that process.
So are you actually on call or called in certain situations where a homicide's occurred, you have a family member at the hospital, they don't know what to do? Are you that type of resource that's called in, or will someone at the hospital give the person your name and your number?
I am not on call. I'm pretty much, people know me by word of mouth and social media. So knowing that my services are available and having my brochure available and, being in communication with different areas within the hospital and police department and just who to know.
And so what other services are we talking about? I think in some cases we have individuals that are killed that are the breadwinners of the family.
Mm-hmm.
Financially. How does that work in terms of your organization, and what resources do you help victims with? I'm thinking of single mothers, widowed with small children. How do they survive?
Well, right now I'm only able to help them with some different financials for the funeral home. There's different resources in the community for the kids around Christmas time who provide toys. There's another organization that also helps help finances go directly to the funeral homes. So there's some resources, but there are also limited resources.
Limited resources. How much is a funeral? I mean, how much is a funeral? I know it varies,
home.
But what's a burial? And I know we're talking about very sensitive topics, but the reality is they want money at the very end of it. So,
and some funeral homes will wait on that crimes victims compensation check, but they also want a certain amount down. A funeral can be from $5,000 to $10,000.
Wow. That's an unbelievable amount of money to bring up. And then you also help with, you said fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
And then also counseling referrals.
There are certain organizations that have free counselor services. Mm-hmm. I mean, once a traumatic experience happened in your life, you may need someone to speak to that's knowledgeable of the circumstance and can help you with different things you're going on in your life.
Have you found in working with individuals that have gone through this a hesitancy to go to a counselor, either because it's just something unusual to them, or there's been barriers in the past, for example, healthcare or lack of healthcare insurance, things like that, to prevent people from becoming more comfortable with that avenue of healing?
Again, this will be a free resource to them. So regardless of their insurance or healthcare benefits, it's a free resource. So some people are hesitant because it's a stranger for them to talk to be able to open up to. That's been the only, problem that I felt.
And so in your own personal life, if I can ask, what if, is counseling something that you've gone through?
I have.
And have you found it to be beneficial in terms of your own healing or is there even such thing as healing in this situation?
It's healing. It's coping. It's being available. It's being able to communicate your problem and being aware of what's going on, to just being more knowledgeable of yourself and your circumstances, what's going through, knowing that it's normal to grieve, it's normal to hurt, and then, you know, it's a time and it's a process, and it's okay.
And do you find, I would assume that when you meet other parents or other individuals that are in this situation, that finding people that have been through like experience helps?
Yes.
In the coping part of it.
Yes, there's some group counseling services where you can actually, you know, meet other families. So you know that you're not completely alone.
Now, I also understand that Alonzo left a child.
He
had two children.
Two children, yes.
And one child wasn't born at the time.
Correct.
But then his daughter.
Correct.
Was it four?
She was two.
I'm sorry, two. And how old is she? She's four.
She's now five.
She's five now. If it's okay, if I could ask, how do you explain the loss of her father? Does she have a memory of her father? And then whether she does or doesn't, how do you explain that the situation to her?
She has a memory of her father. I have named her my honorary board member. When I'm out in the community, she's very much aware of what's going on. She's a very intelligent 5-year-old. Mm-hmm. She knows my motivation's out there helping the community. She knows that her daddy died. She knows there's a killer out there. So it's no secrets. It's no secrets for her to completely understand everything.
And how have you found that, even as a 5-year-old, that she has been able to process or to understand what happened? And I understand she realizes her father's not there, mm-hmm. but in terms of how that anxiety or that experience manifests itself with her, I mean, how does it show, I guess, if it does at all? Is there a sadness there? Has it changed the way she's interacted with children? How have you seen that?
I do believe that she has grieved before. I do believe that she may have acted out in certain days or certain times. I do know that, you know, I keep his memory alive, his face around the house. I have her with me either every weekend or every other weekend. So it's a constant to where she knows. I mean, she knows.
I want to talk to you about the walk that's coming up. This is the walk is on April 1st.
Yes, 9:00, Exodiate Motorcycle Club.
It's 9:00 a.m.
Correct.
Now, you chose, it's not, April 1st is not necessarily the important date. It's the first Saturday in April is the important date.
That is correct. My son's homicide occurred the first Saturday in April.
And so for the foreseeable future, forever, there'll be a walk on the first Saturday in April.
My annual fundraiser,
fundraiser.
Yes.
And this is at Zodiac Motorcycle Club?
That is where we will meet. Yes,
and
that is correct.
What is Zodiac Motorcycle Club?
It's pretty much just a venue right now. We're going to actually, for the first and my first and second, we was completely outside. Mm-hmm. And being, you know, April weather, it's been a little chilly, could rain or whatever. So I decided this year to have some type of shelter. Okay. So we're just going to have some shelter, but we're going to basically be outside in the community, walking the streets, presenting the different Kansas City Unsolved Homicides.
I'm sorry, presenting the what?
Kansas City Unsolved Homicides, the flyer that you have in your hand.
Right.
It'll be an updated flyer with that and letting the people know that these families need justice, need answers, and we need for you to speak up.
Now, I'm looking at a flyer. Well, first of all, before we move on, the Zodiac Motorcycle Club is at 1825 Vine.
Correct.
Kansas City, Missouri, 64108. And you're gonna congregate there at 9:00, and then you're gonna go for a walk. And I know you're gonna walk from 18th and Vine to Woodland, East Truman, and then to the Paseo.
Yes, we're gonna walk the premises of Parade Park.
Okay, what are you hoping the walk accomplishes? I guess let's first start for the participants. You're gonna have individuals there who've also been through similar experiences as your own.
Correct.
And so that provides a camaraderie, I guess, some type of hopefully help with healing.
Uniting the community, bringing awareness, bringing the resources together.
And then in terms of what the walk does for those individuals that may be driving by or may not know anything about this organization or may not have listened to our radio program, what message are you hoping they'll be communicated to them?
We're going to hand out some flyers and let them see the families that's left behind.
And then after you return back to, you're going to return back to Zodiac?
Correct.
Will there be anything at that point?
There will be some people, like I said, Kansas City Crime Stoppers will be speaking. I have someone from a representative from an insurance company to speak to let them know about the insurance packages they have available. We have different giveaways and raffles. So just uniting the community and, you know.
I'm looking, by the way, insurance. What do you mean by insurance?
An insurance agency, you know, life insurance.
Sure.
So educating them on different insurance packages.
Insurance packages, okay. I'm looking here at Kansas City Unsolved Homicides. You've given me this. It's Mama on a Mission at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the total number of, like, it's recent, or is this?
That's not a current one, but that's, no.
Okay, and this is, I'm looking at, there's at least, let's see, 6, 12, 8, 18, 20, 23 and more, it looks like, 30 unsolved homicides.
That's just the families that I'm working with, so yes.
This is just the community you're working with right now.
Correct.
At Mama on Mission.
Correct.
And you talk about being a liaison with law enforcement. I guess, first of all, is the fact that there's unsolved homicides, is it a law enforcement issue? And I'm not trying to, there's no blame casting, but is it law enforcement? Is it witnesses not willing to come forward? Is it lack of resources? Is it all of those things? This is an awful lot of individuals with lives and families and children and grandparents and parents, and it would just seem to me that there's something we could point to and say this is why this homicide has not been solved. Right? I mean, if it was someone that came into Kansas City with no connection and was killed, it's unfortunate, obviously, but there's not as many leads there. Here, my guess is a lot of these individuals, their families live here.
Correct.
They're established here.
It's a combination of everything you just said. I mean, as far as witnesses coming forth, and some of the witnesses do come forth, getting the information to KCPD and having them go through and getting the details or whatever information they may need to give that to the next step. I mean, there's so many different details that's, who knows exactly the true reason.
And is there anything that I can do as a community member, as just someone who's interested in the topic, who wants to help in some way? I guess, what is it I can do? Obviously, coming to the fundraiser, or that's part of it.
Yeah.
But then what will I get from coming to the fundraiser? Meaning, I understand there's a T-shirt, but in terms of the message to me, what would you hope that I would take from coming to meet with you and other people in the community that have been through this horrific experience?
You will be donating to the cause of the community. You'll be giving back to the community. You will be supporting the families of the homicide victims.
Okay.
So some compassion in your heart.
Could you tell us a little bit about Alonzo? I know he was 20 years old at the time of his passing.
Correct.
Could you give us a little bit of an image about Alonzo as we end our this brief interview?
He was my only child, a father of two, one that he was not aware of. Loved his baby girl. Very protective and loving and caring. Very family oriented, who was, you know, something that, you know, he was, how I want to say, yeah, he was very, very, very protective of his family. So that's one of the things that, you know, his legacy will live on as far as him being there for his family and still watching over us.
In terms of the homicide victims that you've been working with, or the family's homicide victim, is there a certain, are there certain common threads that run through either the victim, for example, potentially age? It looks mostly to be men.
Mm-hmm.
Age. Is there a particular a thread or common thread that runs through in terms of who the perpetrators may be, or what the perpetrators may be involved with, or what the victims may be? I don't know. Is there any common thread here, or is it just people from Kansas City that are happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time? I mean, I don't know.
Some of the common threads that I am aware of, some of them are related. Some of them may possibly be some type of retaliation. Some of them are friends. Some of them are family members. But yeah, they all are Kansas City and part of Kansas City.
In terms of the retaliation, in terms of dealing or hearing some of the stories that you've heard, how is it that we as a society and as a community would educate young people, if there is even a way, that picking up a gun in retaliation may not be the answer?
communication, mental health resources, anger management resources, being able to, I guess, bring back the family unit and have that talk. Just letting them know that, you know, circumstances, what happens, what occurs, and just knowing that what's going on is not right. It's a learning process. It's a communication process. Some families, that's all they know. That's what they know. But bringing them outside that area of what their comfort zone is knowing that violence is not the answer.
And what do you mean by that, something that's all they know?
I mean, they may have been brought up in that environment. Just because you was brought up in that environment does not mean you have to live that life.
And so if I could present you with a family now,
mm-hmm.
Who has not been through this, but who could be a family that, God forbid, would ever be in that situation, what services, if you could write your own ticket for them, meaning, you know, I've got this family, they're in a position where they could be in line for something like this just because of whatever choices or things imposed upon them, what would you do? You had infinite amount of money and infinite amount of time. How would you put the family in a situation to minimize the probability of someone wanting to take a retaliatory act like this?
Sitting down and having a conversation at first, seeing what's going on, what are they needs, what are they wants, and how we can get past it. I mean, it will all start with just initial conversation and communication of just seeing what has happened in the past, what can happen in the future.
And in terms of the mental health component, do you find that that's been lacking in the community? In terms of the ability to go to a mental health counselor prior to a crisis, meaning the same way that I work out my body to maintain some type of physical health,
mm-hmm.
presumably going to a counselor could be something that would help me through just life experiences without having to necessarily go through some type of tragedy first.
And then also finding a counselor that fits your needs. Just like if you was working out, all equipment is not the equipment you need to be working on and working out on.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to find that match that's with your personalities that's going to help you with that particular need that you may need.
And are there any counselors or organizations that you've come across that are able to tailor their services to the needs of the community that you deal with?
You have some free counselors, and you have the counselors you actually are that will for your insurance benefits and your needs. So it's still picky and choosy because I had both. So I've seen different people from my insurance companies, from just the free resources. So I had to pick and choose, you know, what the conversation, how the conversation was leading and how we were going with this.
I some of the things we've talked about on the show for a number of years now, there seems to be a unique experience of young African-American men
mm-hmm.
growing up in the community, whether it's waking up and confronting blatant racism, whether it's waking up and confronting subconscious racism by others, whether it's having to deal with the police, whether it's having to deal with the school, whatever, there almost seems to be an additional something there, an additional package of stress and anxiety
mm-hmm.
that just sits there on the shoulder. And what I found in my own personal experience in helping individuals is that the resources to help deal with that, the experience of being a young African-American male, is not, if it's there, it's a lot more hidden than it is for me, for example. And so I found a lot of young men won't go to a therapist, they'll go to smoke a joint. I mean, mm-hmm. that's just the cheap way of doing therapy. And have you also seen that to be true? And maybe are there resources out there to help the situation I'm talking about? Because it's not, you know, no one's diagnosing it in the DSM-5, right? You have people that say they're depressed, they're bipolar, all this stuff. I don't think a doctor's come out and said, all right, this is a mental condition. But in reality, it is, right? Because it's dealing with an awesome amount of stress imposed upon them by something outside of their control.
It takes a lot you would have to spend a lot of time to penetrate through it. Because there's different layers and layers of anger issues, mental health issues, financial issues, emotional issues. So it will have to be time and money and them actually wanting the help and realizing that they need the help.
And are there therapists, out there that you've dealt with, social workers, therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists that are able to, that understand, at least have some understanding of what the individuals that are coming to them are going to talk about.
Yes, there's some out there.
You have. And is there any organizations that you're aware of, or can people that come to talk to you on April 1st at 9 o'clock at Zodiac Motorcycle Club, you could provide them with resources there?
Yes, sir. I can. Yes, I will provide any resources that I can possibly give them. And if I don't know about anything, I have no problems with Googling and trying to figure it out to help them out.
You also talk about networking with government officials in your flyer. What does that entail?
Different state representatives, and also dealing with the police and different organizations. Sometimes just a phone call is not always helps. Sometimes you need multiple phone calls, a couple emails, just to get some response and someone to respond to you.
And so you're helping these individuals that have a voice that otherwise maybe wouldn't.
Correct.
Necessarily have a voice.
Correct.
I guess as we come to a close at this point, we have another 2 minutes to go and then we'll end. I'd ask you to briefly talk about forgiveness. You know, I hope I never in my life have to experience this type of forgiveness, but yet every day we go through experiences that require it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you could help me with that and help our audience with that. How do you deal with that? Do you wake up, you know, how do you process that as you wake up every morning?
Me and my level of forgiveness, I'm not quite there yet, mm-hmm. I guess, because I don't know what happened. If I was to know what happened, it would depend on the reason it occurred. What has happened? I mean, was it justified? Did my son attack you? Or did you just attack him for no reason? So at that point, I think I can give a better answer on my level of forgiveness for my particular situation.
Well, I appreciate the I appreciate your honesty, and I'm honored to have met you today.
Thank you.
I want to also again let everyone know that on Saturday, April 1st, the Walk a Mile in My Shoes 2017 Mama on a Mission, Inc., will take place at the Zodiac Motorcycle Club, 1825 Vine, Kansas City, Missouri, 64108. There'll be a walk with a certain donation, which we don't talk about on the air because of our nature of our radio station, but for a donation, there is a T-shirt. You can also register online, and I did go to your website, which is wonderful, and I appreciated that, and I got to learn a little about you.
Thank you.
And about your son. It's mamaonamission.com. And you can go to mamaonamission.com. You can
actually, it's Mama on a Mission, Inc.
I'm sorry, mamaonamissioninc.com.
It's M-O-M-M-A on a Mission, Inc.com.
Okay.
Or you can give me a call at 816-499-1214.
Wonderful. Well, I think with that, we will appreciate we appreciate you coming in. We appreciate you taking the time to speak to us today. And I hope you're in our prayers. And
thank you.
We hope that you find some resolution.
Thank you.
You're listening to Jaws of Justice on KKFI 90.1.
I do want to remind everyone, or let everyone know, that the music you just heard is another local woman, Saj Kaya, and that was a little bit of her song, Cycle of Pain. And this is Jeff Humfeld. You are listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI, and this is our Women's History Month tribute, so to say. And every show this month has been with local women who are making history and shaping our future. And that was the idea. And today, to end our month, we have a special guest, Christy Childs of Veronica's Voice. Welcome, Christy.
Thanks for having me.
You are the founder and director of Veronica's Voice. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what Veronica's Voice is and what it does.
Sure. We're the voice of the sexually exploited. So I myself am a survivor of commercial sexual exploitation, and we serve those in our community that are marginalized and labeled as prostitutes when we see them as women who of value and that just need to be given an opportunity to do something different.
Veronica.
Yes.
Is named after Veronica Neverdusky.
Mm-hmm.
And you started this in 1993, so you've been at it for a while.
Well, actually, she was killed in 1993.
Okay.
Yeah. And during that time was my transition and extrication out of the life, you know, and it was very difficult. And there weren't any services around to to help me where I could be honest and open about the traumas I had experienced and what my life experiences were. So I utilized other programs in the community, but couldn't discuss my pain and get help that I needed in other areas. So in 2000, after I was completely out of the life and had actually been working in the community and kind of fit in, so to speak, I founded Veronica's Voice.
This is one of the things you mentioned, accessing services.
Yes.
To help you get out of the life. Was there a stigma or was there restrictions maybe on those services that you tried to obtain because of, you know, maybe convictions or what you had experienced?
Well, there's always been a stigma around prostitution in and of itself. I didn't experience those because I didn't tell anyone. So I carried around that secret. And as, you know, as an addict, we know secrets make us sick. So, you know, it was something where I had to find an outlet. And I knew there were other women suffering in our community that needed a safe place to be where there was no judgment and they could discuss what they were experiencing and going through and access other services. And so, I mean, I am glad to say that there seemed to be more accessibility to those things in our community now. And I think it honestly has been due to Veronica's Voice and all the education that we've done in the community, as well as the things that we've done on a national level that has, along with other people around the nation, exposed the realities of this. But there still is, when we talk about sex trafficking, there still is the good victim and the whore. So there is a differentiation between what the government says is a good victim and what is just a whore. Whereas we see anyone that's trapped in commercial sex that can't get out needs to be given the opportunity to get out, that wants out.
Yeah, there is a, what would you call it, a difference that's made. As someone that's been trafficked from overseas and caught up in a sweep or a sting or whatever is considered a victim, where someone that is trafficked locally within the United States is considered a criminal.
Right. And just given that label, absolutely. Yeah, and it's unfortunately, it's still that way. And what I have found is unless, you know, even the underage girls, because we worked on the TVPA, some language that got pushed into that, and that's the Trafficking Victims Protection Act of 2005 that President Bush signed that recognized American children under the age of 18 as victims. Unfortunately, state by state is doing different things around that, and the kids are still criminalized, basically, and a lot of times put in locked facilities. They're pressured to flip on their pimp, which is very dangerous. You know, these pimps, they're not chasing, they're just replacing. But when you go after them, then they will possibly retaliate. So that just puts people in more harm. And this is just to get cases against traffickers, which are also called pimps.
You have a number of different ways that you've been addressing this over the years. One that I we were talking before we came in that is not active anymore, evidently, is the Johns School. Let's explain what that was and what, you know, what the purpose was. What you're trying to accomplish with the Johns School.
Well, it was several different things we were trying to accomplish. One, it's a restorative justice program. And so men that are caught trying to purchase an adult, then they would be court ordered to come to the class. It never worked that the court ordered them really to the class. It was basically, and we still offer it. We just haven't been getting calls like we used to. It was actually attorneys that would tell the men, you know, to give us a call and go through this class. So it was for the restorative justice where those that cause harm give back to those they've caused harm to. It also gave a panel of survivors an opportunity to educate the men on the realities of the harm that it causes, not only in our community, not only to themselves, but where these women had come from and the life that they had led and what it was really like for them and what we really thought of the men who were paying for us. And so it was, there were also other community partners involved in that class. It was a day-long class, and it was really just to bring the reality home of what this really is, that prostitution just isn't a victimless crime, that it does cause harm.
On your website, there's a little thing about, I believe is the Nordic model or the Norway mm-hmm. way of looking at this, and that is basically that the selling of sex is decriminalized, but the buying is criminalized. Now, in this country, we kind of have it the other way around. Is that correct?
I would say that is correct. Unfortunately, people will go, well, no, it's illegal to buy sex. Just until recently, Kansas had a law where it was illegal to sell a hand job, but it was actually legal to get one, to receive it. So that was just crazy, like, language in the law. Yes, men are caught up in sting operations, but they usually just get a citation to show up in court, and so they pay their way out of it. And these are men that are, you know, pillars of the community. These are men that are, you know, they have something to lose. They have careers, they have families, but they are the ones that get this free pass. And they're the one really with the choice, because the one with the money holds the power.
Yep, there you go. Yeah. That's what it ain't about justice, it's about who can pay. Veronica's voice has kind of gone through phases or you know, evolved, continued to evolve over time. And one of the places that you used to have, and I don't believe it, you said is in existence anymore, is what was called the Safe Center. Why don't you explain what that was and how that came about?
Correct. So at the Safe Center, that operated for 14 years. And it was a place for women to come. We would provide lunches. And actually, we had a lot of different women's group that brought in lunches. And we had a lot of volunteers that helped support that. We would have different group topics. We would have processing so the women could process. It was just a safe place for the women to come. What we noticed was we were utilizing some other programs for living spaces for the women. And, you know, after 30 days, they would either have to leave or they would have to pay rent. And it just wasn't working for our population. And we were like, we need to do something different. And we tried to open a home in Missouri. In 2010, we bought a house. Our goal was to have the Safe Center, which was right down the street from the house. And this was in Hyde Park. We wanted to operate the house as just a living home for the women, and then them to get the services down the street as well as the other referrals that we used in the community. Unfortunately, we were not welcome there, and after several years, we did sell. And so we have a home now in Kansas that is open, and that's really our main focus. So we phased out, since it didn't open down the street from our Safe Center, we phased out that program. We were doing outreach to over 300 women a year. We had over 500 women a year coming through our Safe Center. So we were really, it was hopping. It was a hot spot of activity and a lot of work. And so now we have just regrouped and said, okay, let's do something that's more effective, even if it's just going to serve a smaller amount of women. We can give them the quality of services that they need so they can really do something different with their life.
That model that you've developed now, Magdalene KC, I believe. Is
Magdalene, yeah.
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 You know, are you hoping that that's something that other people will copy and maybe do, you know, something similar and try and develop that program?
Absolutely. And here's the great news. We're not the first to do it. We're actually a sister organization of Magdalene out of Tennessee, which is, they have a social enterprise called Thistle Farms. They're very well known. Becca Stevens, the founder, was recognized by President Obama. And so they've created jobs for women. They have the same kind of housing program that we have. So, you know, we work really close with them. And we did on the opening of the house and the model of the house and how it's going to be ran or how it is ran. So they were really of service to us in how to do that. So there's like 33 sister organizations around the country right now of the Magdalene out of Tennessee, and we're one of them, and we're really proud to be part of that.
Well, why don't you explain to us a little bit about just what the Magdalen is and how it works? I mean, you know, what, how many women are involved, what you're doing to help them.
Okay. Well, it's a 2-year living program. So they live in safety. They don't have to pay rent. This is an opportunity for them to heal, for them to get an education. So it's individualized for each one because everybody's at a different place in their life. So some may have a high school diploma, some may not. Some may have vo-tech training of some kind, some may not. Some may have college. So the home is for 5 women. It's a 2-year-long program. Our goal is not just to have one home. We would like to have another home by 2020. And so having 5 women in this home for 2 years, it really gives them that support, community involvement. We want the community involved. We want the women to make that bridge to the community for the women, because the stigma is still there in a lot of ways. I think it is falling away from a lot of people's way of thinking. And I think people have understood that it does seem like kind of this oxymoron thing that the government's saying it's this way, but the reality is it looks this way now that they're starting to open their eyes. So so it's an interesting thing that's happening with this anti-trafficking situation. It's really actually, I think, helping people recognize, well, no, adult women are also victims, and adult women were once those children that were exploited.
NPR has had a couple different reports on this weekend on this issue, and one of the things they talked about was the situation with runaways, and I heard a statistic one time that something like over 50% of kids that run away or are pushed out the door by their family or whatever are introduced to the sex trades within something like 48 hours.
Yeah.
And, you know, I imagine that some of that is, I got a place you can stay, but you got to pay.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just the beginning that works them into, well, you go out and make money instead of just paying me for your, you know, with your services. When you had the Safe Center and now with the home, I'm sure you've found that some women are in a little bit different place than others as far as being able and willing, really willing, ready, mm-hmm. so to say, psychologically and emotionally and all,
right.
to just make that break.
Right.
And that is part of this whole thing, is that they're made to be dependent upon their John or the system mm-hmm. itself, you mm-hmm. know, this way of life.
And it's the known. It's what's known.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So how do you figure out which women are this one's really ready to make the change and let's put some energy into her and help her, and someone else who's just there to get a meal and
right.
and whatever?
We have a process. So part of that is we want them referred, and we're working with several different agencies, especially on the Kansas side. So we work by referral. So we like case managers to reach out to us, and then we do interviews with the ladies. So we're doing interviews. I mean, it's kind of like an application process, you know, because it's really a very limited space. And I mean, it's a beautiful home. There's lots of space per se, but, you know, only 5 beds available. So, yeah, it's been a process to choose who we have in the home. So working with other agencies that are already where the girls have already taken that step. Because when we had the Safe Center, we had, you know, the different drug rehabs bringing the girls down there and different other services providers in the community that would bring the women. So they were engaging in other services. But what we found was everybody wanted to know, well, they're getting ready to graduate our program. Do you have any bed space? So we had partners in the community. One was with the domestic violence shelter. Another one was with City Union Mission. So, but they're limited time, you know, at these places. And so the work we would do with the women after so long, they would be like, well, I've got to go back to what I can do to survive. And it was like, this isn't working. So that's why this program became so valuable.
Well, I know that, you know, organizations like yours run on volunteers, much like KKFI
yes.
does.
Yes.
And why don't you tell people about some of the volunteer opportunities that, that you might have with your organization? And I believe you said that you're now starting to develop, you know, actual job descriptions and the like. So why don't you tell us a little bit about some of that?
Okay, so we're developing job descriptions for some of the volunteer positions. These are positions that, one, some will work within the house, some will work more with me and some other survivors that have gotten into different places in their life that are in better self-supporting, empowered positions in their life. We're developing, one, a committee to create fundraising opportunities for us as survivors to get out and do fundraising to keep Magdalene going. Two, we're also looking for people with business experience, expertise, because we are developing a social enterprise that will, for one thing, give these girls job opportunities, especially those dealing with felons, and help them to become entrepreneurs themselves. So we're using that Thistle Farms model, but we are going to need people with certain types of expertise in the community. Several things we do need for the house are drivers. We need drivers to help get the girls to different appointments, and we are right there in the community. So it's not like a far drive, but it's just we can't have our program coordinator running these girls around to every appointment
exactly.
they have. So we're looking for that. We're looking for women that, you know, may have something to offer to the women, like yoga or some kind of craft or art type of thing, just fun things to come and do in the home with the women.
Well, I did notice on the website that you also had needed people to do grounds work, everything from mow the lawn and to shovel the snow. And
yeah.
of course, if we get snow, that type of thing. So, you know, if there's somebody out there that's got a company that does that and is willing to give a little bit of pro bono, I'm sure you're quite willing to accept that.
Absolutely.
Volunteer opportunities, do any of these volunteer, like you say, some of these are in the home. Mm-hmm. Are you guys still going out on the street and meeting the women where they're at?
If we get a call, because our crisis line is no longer a crisis line.
Okay.
In December 2016, we shifted that to the program coordinator's line. And we have not been doing outreach since the first of the year. That doesn't mean if we didn't receive a call of a crisis situation, we wouldn't engage in that. But we're really trying to put our focus on replicating the Thistle Farms, Tennessee.
Okay.
Magdalene.
Why don't you give some contact information so people that are interested in volunteering or people that need services or people that want to apply, how they can do that. And
okay.
I do want people to know that I have put your website and your Facebook page on our Jaws of Justice radio page. And we have somebody else that's calling in, I guess, how they would contact you.
Okay. Yeah. The administrative offices are 816-483-7101. And the volunteer email address is volunteer@veronicasvoice.org. And, of course, then our website, which is veronicasvoice.org. So there's some information there as well.
I do want to let you know that you are one of my heroes. You've lived, but you also have seen something that really needed to be changed in our community, and you found a way to do that.
Thank you, Jeff.
And
I appreciate that.
That to me, that's really important. That's really what life's all about, as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. You know, you got to give back. Like where you come from, I mean, it's just kind of innate in some people, you know, to do that.
And I want to thank you very much for coming in today. My guest has been Christy Childs of Veronica's Voice.
Thank you.
And up next is the 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Last week, the Texas legislature held a hearing about decriminalizing 1 ounce of marijuana.
My name is William Martin. I direct the drug policy program at Rice University's Baker Institute, which I represent in speaking for House Bill 81. According to massive government surveys conducted annually since the mid-1970s, these are the best data we have on drug use. For most people who use marijuana, it's not even a gateway to more marijuana use, much less a gateway to harder drugs, as the charts on the back of your sheet show. As of 2015, 44% of Americans 12 and older, more than 50% for those under 50, have used marijuana at some time in their lives, but only 8% use it in a way that we could call regular, at least once a month. Less than 1% have used cocaine regularly over the last 25 years. The figure for heroin is less than 0.2%. That's not much of a gateway. Genetics, psychological makeup, and personal and social circumstances play the crucial role. As the 1973 Blue Ribbon Commission appointed by President Richard Nixon noted, the soil is more important than the seed. The individual user, rather than the drug, is the core of the problem. Prohibition and a criminal record will make those problems worse. Available studies indicate that neither decriminalization nor legalization nor medical marijuana drive up adolescent use. In some studies, modest rises in teen use shortly after decriminalization or legalization is followed by a subsequent decrease to former levels. In Colorado, where marijuana has been legal for adults since 2013, teen use has decreased from 22.7 to 2011 in 2011 to 21% in 2015, consistent with a national estimate of about 22%. Decriminalization can save the state, counties, and cities money by no longer jailing people, providing taxpayer-funded legal counsel to indigent defendants, or monitoring offenders through probation and parole after they are released. The collateral consequences of conviction for even minor drug offenses are great, affecting employment, housing, education, earning power, families, and higher levels of distrust toward police. As has been noted, these consequences are unevenly distributed. The data are clear that African Americans are far more likely to be arrested, convicted, and incarcerated than whites. Latinos are also more likely than whites to receive criminal sanctions disproportionately. Minority populations know this, and it reduces their respect for the law, and it loosens the psychic bond to society and its norms. That harms democracy and the rule of law. House Bill 81 won't erase all those inequities, but it will make a huge difference, and I urge you to support it.
Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
We hope you've enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and the guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, or its staff and volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio page on Facebook. If you have a show idea or you want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website at kkfi.org. This is your engineer for Jaws of Justice Radio, Beth Pike. And be sure to tune in Thursday mornings at 6 a.m. when I host the Thirsty Thursday edition of your Morning Buzz. Our outro music is Better Man, and that's from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Khadija and the White Guy at 9 a.m. on Thursdays, and then Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues. That's with Luscious Lynn. And then at noon, it's Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. You'll want to stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and then Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo en Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.